Talk of the history of black resistance to that situation, and that's the theme proposed for this afternoon. Many of you will remember that almost just over 3 years ago, in June of 1976, Soweto blew up, one of the black township, the area for blacks 15 miles outside of Johannesburg. And about a month after Soweto blew up, Steve Biko, a banned person, was picked up by the police, held without charge for about 6 months, and questioned intensively by the police. Blacks in South Africa lost the right of habeas corpus, a fundamental Western human right which says that when you are picked up by the police, you have the right to be charged with a crime. Blacks in South Africa don't have that right. They can be held for 9 months at a time, renewable, on an indefinite basis, and many hundreds of them are today. So after the riots started in June of 76, Biko and many of his colleagues were picked up and held. One of Steve's closest friends, Mapetla Mohapi, was held in detention for about 2 or 3 days, and then his family, young wife, was informed that he had died. We have been told by security police in their administration of torture tactics later, they have told some of the people who they were torturing how Mapetla died, a common method of torture by the police in South Africa, who have been trained with our tax dollars by the CIA in the administration of torture tactics. That a common method of torture is to take a wet towel and to wrap it around the person's mouth and nose and to squeeze it from behind until they lose consciousness. And occasionally, of course, the towel is held a bit too long and person never wakes up. So soon after Steve was detained, a very bright, very energetic, enthusiastic young guy named Mapetla was dead. Steve and many of his other colleagues were held from July until about December of 76 when he was released. A few days after he was released, I happened to be passing through his hometown with a group of people on my way back from a conference who said that we had to stop at some place and pick up a baby crib, and I was in a Volkswagen bus and we were playing bridge and I didn't pay much attention where we were going, and the bus stopped to pick up this baby crib and I got out and there was an old church building and a couple people walked behind and I stretched my legs and walked behind and saw the car of my friend Elred Stubbs, a white Anglican priest who of all whites in South Africa was probably the closest to the black consciousness movement. And I was surprised to find his car there and learned a few minutes later that this was the headquarters of the Black Consciousness Movement. And Elred came out of the door a minute later and said, oh, you picked a fine time to come. Steve is inside, and I was just telling him about you this morning. Come in, I want you to meet him. And that's how we met. He invited me to come and see him sometime. So when I was back in the country about 3 or 4 months later, we got together and spent a morning together discussing some work that I was doing at that time in South Africa and also some of his thoughts about Americans and the ways in which Americans might be helpful to what they were trying to do. The next time I saw him was a month or two later when I had gotten into a lot of hot water in the work that I was doing. I was working with some blacks in a project that's not worth explaining about right now. And I was driving through his hometown on the evening of June 16th, 1977, the 1 year anniversary of the blow up in Soweto, and I knew that the Black Consciousness Movement had called for this to be a day of national mourning and remembrance for the 1,000 school children who had been killed by police when the uprising occurred. So I was a little bit intimidated about contacting him, but I thought, really, this is the guy whose advice I would most like to get in the problems that I was facing at that point. So I thought, well, at least I'll give him a call as I drive through town. That can't hurt. And I called him up and explained the situation on the phone for about 10 minutes, and he said, well, I really think this is too important of an issue to just deal with quickly on the phone. Can't you stay in town overnight and meet me the next morning? And at 7:30 the next morning, cold winter morning, he was there, and we talked for a while, and this problem, which had perplexed me to the point of severe ulcers and really had me totally confused about what to do. This guy listened to very carefully for a half an hour and then said, well, the situation is 1, 2, 3, and laid it right out. Beautiful, ingenious solution. I mention it because it reflects some of his own concern to keep bridges of communication open with whites. And there's a sense in which his death, I think, has robbed whites perhaps of more than it has of blacks. The guy was famous as someone among his own people who was committed to keeping lines of communication open with whites. And he was well known for having good, friendly relations with the whites that he was sometimes most critical of. Bright guy. Anybody ever heard Martin Marty speak? You know, real electric kind of guy, you can hardly keep up with him. Steve is the only person I've ever met who has that kind of a quick mind. Good vocabulary, articulate. I regularly had to stop him and ask him to define an English word he was using. Warm, good sense of humor. He was held those final 6 months of 1976, then released in December, just before Christmas, free as a banned person. He wasn't allowed to meet with more than one person at a time, except members of his immediate family. He wasn't allowed to travel outside of the police district in which he lived. He wasn't allowed to engage in various kinds of activities that the government told him he couldn't do. And that's what it means to be a banned person in South Africa. There are hundreds. Until 2 years ago this Sunday, when late one night, a roadblock which had been set up for other reasons accidentally discovered Steve Biko outside of his police district. This is something that he regularly did. He traveled around the country. He was fearless. It was a symbol of great hope for blacks in Port Elizabeth, 100 miles away from King Williamstown, that Biko would show up there and show up in the downtown department store one day and be back in King Williamstown, his hometown, before the security police found out about it. And then the news would go around the black township that night. Biko was here. You can't stop that guy. But one night, he was caught accidentally at a roadblock and detained for the last time. August 19th, 1977, he was picked up. September 12th, he was dead. Now, I should say that he had not been tortured the way many people are. The police were very sensitive to the fact that he knew a lot of international people and that international media people particularly talked to him often. So when they held him for 6 months in 1976, they were careful not to lay a finger on him. Instead, they detained, on the same day that they detained him, a very close friend of his, Tanjiwe Mtinso, beautiful young woman, a newspaper reporter for the Daily Dispatch, a white English-speaking newspaper in East London. They detained her the same day they detained him, and they held her in Transkei, never questioned her once, but came and beat her every time questioning broke down between Steve and his questioner. In other words, they never laid hands on Steve, but they would question him, and he always had certain conditions under which he answered the questions that police raised him and other conditions that he didn't. If he felt that it was unreasonable for them to question him beyond a 14-hour period without food or without the ability to relieve himself or even sit down, he might at some point just say, okay, you know, I think this is a little ridiculous, and he would stop answering their questions. And when he and Tanjiwe, who was released on the same day as Steve, compared notes later, they discovered that she had been very severely beaten every time he stopped answering questions. And this was a way of putting pressure on him to cooperate with the police. But he also said that when they did lay a finger on him, if that day came, he would respond, because he said the police's strategic employment of violence will always break you down eventually if you let it. There's no way you can control it. So they come into a questioning situation. You're held in solitary confinement. No one can see you or talk to you. Tanjiwe, by the way, a newspaper reporter was banned as she was released, so that as a banned person she couldn't be quoted in any of the news media, and whites in South Africa don't know her story about having been beaten every time Steve refused to answer questions. His philosophy on how you deal with the torture was that it can only hurt you if you play that game. The police come into a questioning situation with strict instructions to hit you 5 times and no more than that. And then they go away and they have a conference and they decide what would be the next step of violence to escalate to if you want to break this guy down. And he said the only way you can control that is if they hit you once, hit them back. And pretty soon there's a whole fight ensues and they can't count how many times they've hit you, and then that spoils their whole strategy of how they break you down. He said, unfortunately, one of the results of that is that they may end up using more violence than they intend to, with the result that they may kill me someday without even meaning to. There was a police-held inquest into the circumstances surrounding his death. The autopsy cited that he died of brain damage. He was being held in solitary confinement. No black people were ever allowed to talk to him from the time the police first picked him up. So we will never know precisely the circumstances of his death. That he was a strong, healthy man when he was taken into detention, and to be dead 4 weeks later of brain damage would suggest some foul play. Some of you may have seen in the newspaper a week or two ago that the government has now settled in a damage suit with the family by paying them $80,000. Which, to my way of thinking, is some clear indication that they do accept some responsibility for his death. Now, why did he die? More importantly, why did he willingly pursue a course of action which he knew would probably leave him dead someday? And that's really the focus of what I'd like to talk about this afternoon. But I think that to understand what's happening on the part of black people in South Africa today, we really need to look a little bit at their history. I think it's great that Americans are beginning to take an interest in the liberation movements of Africa, but too often we pass judgment on what are the tactics which they can and cannot use before we know their own history of using various kinds of tactics. So this afternoon I'd like to move from this point onward for a while, just looking at some of the history of black resistance since 1912. We can assume that blacks have in one way or another resisted from the beginning their disenfranchisement, but it's since 1912 that there have been, to me, particularly interesting developments in this regard. Prior to 1910, the missionaries always told the African people not to be too concerned about the fact that the local white population doesn't seem to respect you. They said, don't worry about that, because really, the local whites are not in charge. The Queen of England runs this situation, and we missionaries know her to be a good, moral, Christian, upstanding woman who will always look out for your interests. So don't worry about how the local whites feel about you. They're not in charge. The Queen is. But 1910, as some of you will remember from the history lesson this morning, 1910 was when the Queen of England signed away her rights to South Africa by declaring it a self-governing member of the Commonwealth. So there followed in 1912 some organized response of concern on the part of blacks, well-educated, elite Christian blacks in South Africa, who formed in 1912 the African National Congress, ANC. And this is a group of relatively well-educated, some of them university-trained, blacks who were, for the most part, Christians, who said, we believe what the whites have told us about about this better way of solving human conflict than war. We trust them and we believe in them and we have faith that as Christians, war is not the best way to try and solve our problems. So the ANC in 1912 adopted a two-pronged strategy of trying to negotiate with the whites for a better situation of human rights. They said, we will operate legally and nonviolently to try and negotiate with the whites to help them see that we don't have a good deal and we deserve more rights. But we will very strictly abide to this legal and nonviolent strategy for negotiating with the whites. And they did maintain a commitment to that, that strategy from 1912 until 1949. In 1949, they said, maybe it's time to take stock of our situation to evaluate how we're doing.
They said, the few blacks who had the right to vote in 1912 have lost that right by 1949. The few blacks who could own land in 1912 have lost the right to own land by 1949. Furthermore, in 1948, the Afrikaners had come to power on the political platform of promising apartheid. So in 1949, when the African National Congress examined their strategy and how it was doing, they were concerned that they were going backwards, not making progress, that they had fewer civil rights in 49 than they had when they started out in 1912. So they said, maybe part of the problem is our strategy. And maybe we need to change our tactics in order to get through to the white population. Because even still in 1949, whites believed very strongly, as they still do today, that blacks were happy. So they said, we're going to change our tactics. But being the peace-loving people that we are, we can't drop a commitment to nonviolence, so we'll drop our commitment to legal activity. And they're followed during the 1950s, the rise of civil disobedience. This was now blacks saying, we are prepared to nonviolently break certain laws that we think discriminate against us as a way of testifying to the whites that we're not satisfied with our condition here. Part of the problem is that whites think that we're happy. We've been trying to tell them that we're not satisfied. We haven't, we've failed in that exercise over the last 37 years. So maybe it's necessary that we even break the law and risk going to jail in order to say to the whites that we're not satisfied with the situation here. In particular, they chose the pass laws to civilly disobey. Pass laws are some of the legislation of apartheid which require that all blacks must carry a document on them at all times stating where it is they have permission to be. And this is a way of controlling the migration of blacks from those shaded Bantustan areas that I talked about this morning into the cities and into the areas where whites are. By forcing blacks to carry a pass on them at all times, police can stop blacks in the cities and demand to see their pass. If they have a pass, which proves that they have a job to be in the city, then they're all right. If they don't, then they can be fined or imprisoned or sent back to the Bantustan. There are in South Africa every day 3,000 pass arrests. And the average trial for a pass offender is 2 minutes. I have friends who have gone to the store to pick up some milk or groceries for the whites that they work for, and having left their pass behind, met a policeman who asked them to produce their pass. When they couldn't, they were jailed, rather than being allowed to go home 2 blocks and get the pass to show that they did have a job in that area. So blacks, when the pass laws were introduced and increased during the 1950s, said, here's a piece of legislation which clearly discriminates against us as blacks. Whites are free to go wherever they want in the country, except in the black townships. And we blacks have our mobility restricted, so we will choose the pass laws as a way of protesting, illegally, but nonviolently. And these protests grew throughout the 1950s. They spread to include some general strikes as well as demonstrations in which blacks would gather and burn their passes as an act of civil disobedience, and many thousands were arrested and sent to prison for this activity. As civil disobedience grew among blacks in the 1950s, so did police power to put down such activity. It was during the 1950s that massive police state powers were invested, were passed in the Parliament of South Africa. It was in 1952 that blacks lost the right of habeas corpus and could be held for as much as 48 hours without charge. It was in 1952 or 4, I forget right now, that the bannings first began, where individuals were silenced through banning. And in particular, the leadership of the ANC, the African National Congress, was silenced during the 1950s by having banning orders placed on them or by being imprisoned, usually without charge. And as this primary level of the ANC leadership was wiped out and put in prison or silenced in one way or another. The secondary level leadership of the ANC, which was not of as high of a caliber, was commandeered by white radicals who came out of the now banned Communist Party of South Africa. In 1950, the Communist Party of South Africa was banned, and when that happened, whites who had been working in the Communist Party, it was primarily a white-led organization at that time, moved into the ANC as another vehicle available for seeking protest and seeking change. And these white radical communists very quickly took over control of the ANC, largely because the primary level leadership of the ANC had been wiped out and the secondary level leaders were not of a caliber sufficient enough to withstand the influence of these radical whites. This led a lot of blacks, particularly black Christians within the ANC, to become very concerned that their movement was no longer being controlled by them and was heading in a direction that they didn't feel they could support. So in 1959, there was a breakaway from the ANC and the PAC was born, the Pan-Africanist Congress. PAC, led by Robert Sobukwe until his death a year or two ago. Robert Sobukwe, a firmly committed Anglican, said that we are an all-black liberation movement. We are for blacks only, and this is not a form of racism so much as it is a way of making sure that we don't have white communists trying to take over our organization. And for 1 year, the PAC operated alongside the ANC, growing very rapidly, and in particular, embarking on some strategies of seeking the support of black Christians in South Africa for the liberation movement, in particular, the Christians from the independent churches, which I described on Monday in my first talk. The PAC enjoyed a very brief life of only 1 year. On March 21st, 1960, they opened a new wave of pass law demonstrations. The first demonstration was called for a place named Sharpeville, and in front of the police station at that place, about 3,000 African men, women, and children, unarmed, gathered to sing a few songs, make a few speeches, and then in one collective act of civil disobedience, burn their passes. After burning their passes, they turned to the police station and said, okay, we're prepared to be arrested and to go to jail as a way of testifying nonviolently to the people of South Africa that we want change. The police introduced a new tactic at dealing with these civil disobedient demonstrations on that day, a tactic which showed up elsewhere in the weeks to come. They opened fire with machine guns on the unarmed crowd. 69 people were killed, 150 injured. Most of those who were shot in the back as they fled the police. That same tactic of openly firing on peaceful crowds was used time and again in the months ahead until such demonstrations stopped. A few months after the Sharpeville Massacre, as it's come to be called, the ANC and the PAC were banned or declared illegal as organizations. And 1960 became known as a crackdown year. When the ANC and the PAC became banned, they moved outside of South Africa, set up headquarters in Dar es Salaam and London and New York, and claimed to begin organizing the guerrilla strategy. They said, we now, some Africans at this point said, we now give up on the possibility of seeking peaceful change in South Africa. As I said earlier, I think it's great that we Americans begin taking an interest in the liberation movements of Africa, but I think it also behooves us, before we self-righteously condemn any resorting to violence there, to know something about the history of the African people in trying to use nonviolent tactics. They don't respect us for telling them that nonviolence is the only way when we don't know their own 50-year history of commitment to nonviolence. And this brief introduction is no substitute for that education, which I think we need to begin researching before we tell them whether or not they have any right at all to use guns. Following 1960, from 60 to 68, was a very depressing time in South Africa. Nothing happened above ground in the way of protest. It was a period in which Steve Biko has later written, blacks were paralyzed by a fear that any sort of political activity would involve police repression. Black parents taught their children, yeah, the situation here is wrong. Whites are not treating us fairly. But above and beyond all else, we must survive. And any sort of political activity will interfere with your abilities to survive. So we must lay low politically. It was a period in which blacks were paralyzed by fear and characterized by hopelessness. In 1960, Steve Biko was 12 years old, 30 years old when he died. As a 12-year-old kid growing up in the urban townships of South Africa during the 1950s, he must have had a sense of excitement about the growing mood of protest. A 12-year-old kid would have been excited if a protest march came to town that day. And just at the point when he was beginning to enter adolescence and would have been participating in those kind of marches, suddenly everything stopped. Nothing happened. And we entered an era of hopelessness. 1966, he went to university. And with other young university students, he was at a medical school training to be a doctor. With other young idealistic university students, they talked about, what is it we can do? What can we offer our people to give us some hope? We can't maintain this situation of paralysis by fear. We got to do something. We got to have some hope. And as they examined their situation, they decided that maybe the government's actions dictated to them that they would not be allowed to work anymore on the problem of a white superiority complex. That's what they had been trying to do during the, from 1912 to 1960, was to convince whites that they were not so superior that they deserved to have all the rights and blacks none of the rights. So that the whole thrust of black protest up until 1960 was aimed at a white superiority complex. But Biko and his colleagues in 66, 67, 68 began saying, maybe there's another problem we need to face here. Maybe as well as the problem of a white superiority complex, we also have to grapple with the problem of a black inferiority complex. Because after 300 years of experiencing the racial discrimination which we have, we blacks have begun to think of ourselves as inferior. We've not been allowed to hold any leadership positions, so we haven't accumulated leadership skills, and the result is we don't think of ourselves as leaders. And maybe we need to be working on that problem. It's interesting that Biko arrived at this conclusion from work that he was engaged in with liberal whites. And when the Black Consciousness Movement was born in 1968, it was the liberal whites, not the conservative whites, who were most offended by Biko and his colleagues. It was the liberal whites who preached against Biko, and the conservative whites who applauded him in the early days of his movement. There is in South Africa three kinds of universities. There are Afrikaans-speaking white universities, which have an Afrikaans student organization called the ASB, the Afrikaanse Studentenbond. Then there are white English-speaking university campuses, which has a student organization called NUSAS, National Union of South African Students, which was multiracial and open to anyone. And then there are black university campuses, one for the Xhosas, one for the Zulus, one for the Tswanas, one for the Sesotus, so forth and so on. So three kinds of campuses, black, English white, and Afrikaans white. And two kinds of university student organizations. The Afrikaans University Students Organization, which was for Afrikaans students only, and NUSAS, which was for all students. But most of the members of NUSAS were white because there were more English-speaking white students in university than there were black university students. And also because some of the black universities were not allowed to participate in NUSAS because the principal of the university would ban membership in NUSAS. The principal of the university was likely to be a conservative government-appointed person, and he would consider NUSAS to be a liberal or even a radical organization. And if it was a political-like campus, he might well say to his students on the campus, you will not be allowed to participate in NUSAS. So that further cut the number of blacks who could participate in NUSAS. Biko went to a very apolitical campus, the medical school in Durban, and he very quickly got involved in Nusants. And within a year or two, rose to created a strong Nusants organization on his campus, and rose to a position of prominence nationally within the Nusants organization. He wasn't an office holder, but he had the respect of white Nusants leaders as someone who spoke for blacks. And it was only in the experience of working with those liberal whites in the multiracial organization that Biko came to feel it was necessary for blacks to withdraw from contact with whites and form their own black organization for a while. Now, when they did that, the government applauded them. They said, great, this is what we've been talking about, separate development. Each race must work on its own. And so the government appreciated the birth of Nusants, and those black campuses which had not been allowed to, the government appreciated the birth of SASO, South African Students Organization, the black student organization. And those black campuses which had not been allowed to participate in Nusants were now encouraged to participate in SASO. The liberal whites preached against SASO and said, this is a new form of racism. But Biko said to them, it's not racism. It's an interim measure whereby we reestablish within ourselves a sense of dignity, whereby we rebuild our sense of inferiority. And once we are strong enough and we feel that we can come into a group and not feel inferior in your presence, then we can have true integration. He was critical of what we call integration in this country. Integration to me, as a liberal American, means that I am supposed to be less nervous if some blacks want to come and be here at Holden Village, or if they want to move in down the street from me, or if they want to come to my educational institutions. As long as they study what I want to study, as long as they keep up their house the way I want to keep up my house, and live the way I want to live, I'm not supposed to be nervous about that. And Steve was very critical of that. He said, that's not integration, that's assimilation. Integration is where you have two groups that, out of a mutual respect for each other, kind of come together and each give each other a little bit of what they have to offer. That's integration. But before we can ever hope to have integration in South Africa, we must first, as blacks, withdraw and rebuild a sense of who we are. So they broke away from the multiracial liberal student organization in 1968 and formed SASO, South African Students Organization, as an all-black students movement, the beginning of the black consciousness movement. Very quickly, they said, we got a lot of work to do if we're going to reestablish a sense of dignity about ourselves, and they started setting up all kinds of community development projects, a medical clinic, a dressmaking project, a leatherworking project, high school students organization, all kinds of organizations. There was a renaissance of people's organizations that began sprouting up within the black community all over South Africa. The philosophy was, we will create institutions for ourselves. Zanempilo Medical Clinic was black designed, black built, black staffed, black run, from start to finish, a black project that accomplished two kinds of impacts on the black community. Number one, it said to the rural Xhosa mother who brought her child to the medical clinic, for the first time in her life, she could get good medical care from her own black people. She didn't have to go to a white-run clinic in order to get medical care for her child. And this changed the way she thought about herself as a black person. And secondly, the person who ran Zanempilo Clinic was now the first black to get the experience of running a medical clinic. And we all know that leadership skills come out of leadership experience, and where you've not had experience, it's difficult to develop the skills. So blacks began accumulating leadership skills, which they had been systematically denied for hundreds of years, and they also began making a witness to themselves that we can do things for ourselves, and sometimes we can even do them better. Because that rural Xhosa mother who brought her child found that the people who she was dealing with now spoke her language and knew where she was coming from, culturally. These symbols of new black pride began springing up all over the country as blacks began addressing themselves to their own problems first, leaving the problem of a white superiority complex to the guerrillas who they said would operate outside the country. Steve once told me that he considered the guerrilla movement's relevant activity, but not something that he personally would involve himself with, because he felt that A, violence was always a dehumanizing activity, and B, what he was really, what he felt there was a concurrent need for, as well as attacking the problem of a white superiority complex, was a rehumanization of black consciousness, so that he felt ultimately he didn't want some black guerrillas to come and take over a society in which blacks had not equipped themselves to lead. So what the black consciousness movement sought to deal with was an above-ground, legal, nonviolent, again, form of activity which would strengthen the black people. Biko has written in this book of his writings that the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed, and that fear within the black community was ultimately their greatest danger. So they set out through the organization of the Black Consciousness Movement to wipe out fear in the black community. And the proof of their success was visible beginning in June of 76, when 15-year-old children began day after day after day marching armed with the top of a garbage can and a few rocks in front of machine guns. There are films available, excellent films on South Africa available. One of them called 6 Days in Soweto shows black school children throwing rocks at the police and getting shot. I mean, you see this kid standing here taking these rocks and throwing them, and he throws them and he gets hit, you know. And instead of running, he picks up another stone and he keeps throwing stones and he gets shot 2 or 3 times until he falls to the ground and dies. Children, 14 years old, went to the streets day after day after day to do that. And Americans are still wondering if the situation in South Africa is going to get violent. Police have never known how to deal with this movement that was focusing on strengthening itself rather than an insurrection against whites. And for that reason, every step of oppression which they've tried to take against the black consciousness movement has in the end worked against them. Initially they supported the movement, and then they found out that some of the things being said by these young black students were actually quite radical and were threatening to the whites. So then in March of 1972 they banned, it was 8 or 10 black consciousness movement leaders. Steve by this time had left his medical studies in order to pursue this work full time. He was working with black community programs. Black community programs was the community development wing of the black consciousness movement. Now I talk about the black consciousness movement, or BCM, as, you know, an entity out there somewhere. It's not. There's never been an organization called the black consciousness movement. Instead, it is a name given to this renaissance of organizations which sprang up in South Africa. All of them operating in a similar spirit, based on a similar philosophy, but not organizationally connected with each other. So there was a university students organization, then there was a high school students organization, and they operated in the same spirit, but they were not formally part of the same organization. And the community development wing of the black consciousness movement was black community programs, which set up Zanapilo Medical Clinic and the dressmaking project and stuff like that. And Steve was working with them in Durban until March of 1972, when he was banned. And in banning him, the government sent him back to King Williamstown, about 600 miles away, and told him now that he must stay there. So what they did was, Steve went to King Williamstown and opened a new branch of black community programs. A year later, they rewrote his banning order, stating that no longer would he be allowed to work with black community programs. So he turned the local organization into the hands of somebody else, and he started a new organization, Zimele Trust. Zimele means we stand on our own. And it was a scheme aimed at rehabilitating black prisoners who came out of, black political prisoners who came out of prison. It would make a loan to them so that they could buy a truck and set up a little transport business of their own or something like that. Get back on their feet after they had been serving time in prison for political charges. And the whole history of the black consciousness movement has been one of being pursued by the police, but the police take action which in effect only in the long run results in the spreading of the movement. And I believe the key to whether or not that newest generation of spreading is successful lies in our hands today. About 2 years ago right now, a friend of mine asked Steve shortly before he was detained for the last time, what's going to happen if the police act against you? If there's a crackdown against the black consciousness movement, just like there was a crackdown in 1960. If that happens today in 1977, are we going to experience another dead period like we did from 60 to 68, where nothing happened in the way of black protest after the ANC and the PAC were banned? And Steve's response was no, that can never happen again. Because in 1960, the strength of the movement was organizationally based. And once you wipe out the organization, there's nothing left. But he said, we today have created a new mood in the urban townships of South Africa. And this is where my classification of blacks as farm laborers, Bantustan peasants, and urban blacks become important. The black consciousness movement operated primarily among those urban blacks who are better educated and know more about the rest of the world than some of the others. Where the BCM worked in rural areas, it very quickly was gaining the allegiance of the rural peasants and their respect, because the BCM respected the rural peasants, and the rural peasants in return responded with the loyalty toward the BCM. But it had very little time to expand in that direction. And it had done virtually no work among farm laborers, because in order to work among farm laborers, you must first win the support of the white farmer on whose land the laborers live. And that, of course, was more difficult. Steve predicted that no matter what the government did to them today, it wouldn't be able to suppress them, because there was that mood of fearlessness, which he said meant that blacks were convinced it was better to stand up and die expressing their psychological liberation from fear, rather than to go on living paralyzed by a fear which left you really just a shell of a human being. It's better to die expressing our liberated beliefs than to go on living enslaved by fear. I believe that when the Soweto and the urban townships blew up in 1976, it was directly the product of having spread this philosophy among urban blacks. And the fact that those townships are still very strongly militant in their resistance to the police today is some evidence that we will not go through this kind of a period. September 12, 1977, Steve was dead. 5 weeks later was October 19, 1977, when beginning at 3 a.m, police began rounding up every leader of every black consciousness movement organization, putting them in prison, confiscating all resources of all the organizations of the black consciousness movement, and banning 17 organizations in one day. And the BCM experienced their own version of a crackdown. From October 1977 until about 1 year ago right now, most of the main leaders of the black consciousness movement were held in prison without charge, many of them being tortured. And as they began getting released from prison a year ago, most of the major leaders began leaving the country. Today, the focus of the black consciousness movement leadership is now living outside of South Africa. I believe the most important single individual is a man named Pichana. Steve was the first president of SASO, this black students organization, and to give you an idea of his leadership style and his own personal humility, at the end of his one-year term, people said, okay, now you run again. You know, you've done a good job as president, the first president of SASO, and you run again because we appreciate your leadership. And he said no, he refused to run. He said what's necessary is that we develop leadership skills on the part of a lot of us rather than invest too much leadership influence in one person. So he went to the background. Pichana was the second SASO president. Likewise, Steve wrote a series of columns in the SASO newsletter and signed them Frank Talk. They were called, the column title was I Write What I Like, and they were signed Frank Talk. And the reason for that was not that he was afraid to admit that he was connected with them, but that he said the emphasis should be on the ideas in the article, not on their author. Another illustration of his own humility in the style that he followed of leadership. Now, I believe that that style is going to pay off as Pichana, who is studying theology in King's College London today, and other leaders who have left the country as they move into positions of new forms of leadership. As well as Pichana in London, I think the second most important refugee to leave South Africa in the last year is a man named Ben Kwapa, who came to Cleveland, strong congregationalist, and is studying social work there. I note the Christian relationship or the Christian faith of these people because I think it's important. Most of the leaders of the Black Consciousness Movement are themselves Christians. It is not a Christian organization. They say that they are open to anyone who experiences racial discrimination in South Africa, whether that person be a Muslim or a Hindu or follow traditional African religious belief or be a Christian. They don't want to, it's not a Christian organization. Yet the fact remains that most of the members and most of the major leaders are themselves firmly committed Christians. In this book you can read quotes from Biko on does God exist, what is God's nature, and what is Christ, or what about Christ? You can also read an essay that he wrote entitled The Church as Seen by a Young Layman, and one or two other theological essays that he has in this collection of his writings, which involves his opinions on a wide variety of subjects, from the church to racism to the role of white liberals to American foreign policy, the whole works. By the way, I meant to mention this at the beginning as a kind of introductory note, self-introduction, that most of the information that I'm reporting to you I learned after Steve's death. I met him personally and got to know him a little bit while he was alive, but I learned a lot more about the movement after his death because Elred Stubbs, the English priest who had introduced me to Biko, had gotten kicked out of South Africa before Steve's death and is living now in Lesotho, that country I pointed out this morning, which is surrounded by South Africa but is technically independent. He lives on a mission station there where he's committed to a life of prayer. And Stubbs smuggled a letter to me a couple of weeks after the October crackdown saying that he had been asked to do a biography of Biko and would I be willing to go and see the family and get their permission for this, and if they gave the permission, then dig up whatever information we could get about Steve. And so my last 6 weeks in South Africa, I got heavily engaged in a process of digging up the writings for this book and getting them smuggled out of South Africa. And that's when I learned most of what I'm sharing with you now about the Black Consciousness Movement and their history. The only place I know of that you can find any history of the Black Consciousness Movement is in this book. The book has two parts. The first part, the main part, are 19 chapters of Steve's own thought, his own words, on a wide variety of subjects, as I said. And then the last 60 pages of the book are a memoir written by Stubbs called Martyr of Hope, in which he describes a little bit about who Steve was, his life, and some of the history of the Black Consciousness Movement, and why some of us think this man is probably the best example of the life and death of a Christ figure in our time. First time I know of that the work of a major political revolutionary has been set in an undeniably Christian context, and I hope that we Christians will take advantage of what our own body of Christ in that part of the world is saying to us. The book is $8.95, which is a pretty good price for hardcover these days, and it's published by Harper & Row. I have three copies I can sell here today. Otherwise, order it from your bookstore.
The other readers, they have that same commitment to communication with the Christ.
Yeah, I believe they do. Now, there are, of course, increasing numbers of blacks in South Africa, particularly the younger students, who have lost that commitment. I mean, they just say, what does it do? What good is it that Biko talks to international media people because he dies, Americans learn a lot about his death, and still don't know anything about his life. The information that I've told you about the Black Consciousness Movement, I have found to be non-existent in advanced seminars of African studies in major universities, let alone the so-called experts sitting in New York offices representing us as church leaders or whatever. People know nothing about the Black Consciousness Movement because the liberal Americans who are involved with South Africa and who try and study it and make it a focus of their own education, they take their information from the wave of refugees who came out of South Africa in 1960, the ANC and the PAC people, when Biko was 12 years old. He has revolutionized the situation inside the country. The whole focus of their activity was internal. So particularly in the United States, the situation is a little bit better in Europe, but particularly in the United States, people are totally ignorant to this day about what Biko stood for, what the history of his movement was. Now that bothers me because I think that Christians particularly would be excited about this kind of a movement and would find this something we can support. You know, we sometimes get nervous about the fact that it seems the only way we can identify with the liberation movement is by training guerrillas or something, and many of us are very nervous about that, so we don't want to do that. Well, here's a group of people offering very viable alternatives, and we don't know anything about them.
Do you see a parallel between Biko and Dr. Martin Luther King and the
movement? Yeah, in many ways, in terms, you know, and many of the themes are the same in terms of speaking for black pride and that kind of thing. But Biko also was said there are some, while there are parallels to the rise of black power in the United States, there are also some differences. For example, the black power movement in the States has largely been, and this is my understanding of his opinion, you really ought to take it from him yourself rather than through the eyes of a white liberal, you know. But he said blacks in the United States during the late 1960s began asking for they're a bigger slice of the American pie. They wanted their fair share of participating in the dominant value structure of America. He said, a difference between us and them is in South Africa, we reject the notion that we should buy into a white value system. Now, we want the right to be Africans in Africa. And we think it's only fair that whites who want to come and live in Africa as a minority group ought to be willing to, you know, be a little bit African in the way that they live. So that they felt that there was a certain difference, too, that blacks in this country were asking for the right to be Americans, whereas blacks in South Africa were asking for the right to reject Western values and to be African. In many cases, yes. But when the New York Times writes a story in their Sunday magazine on the progress of blacks, they're talking about blacks being paid better wages and making it into the same kinds of jobs as whites and, you know, living in the white suburbs and that kind of thing, the black middle class. That's what we consider to be the progress that blacks have made in this country, is the fact that they are increasingly being able to live the way we do. But there has been a certain emphasis on the recovery of black pride and that sort of thing. Yeah, it's good, we move in the form, okay, well let's take questions now, and tomorrow, when I talk about what I think we need to be doing, that's when I want to talk about what is it that these colleagues of Biko, Ben Quapo was Steve Biko's boss in black community programs. Biko was always worked under Quapo's leadership. For a while, Steve was director of the Eastern Cape branch of black community programs. Ben Quapo was national director. He's the guy in Cleveland. Pichana was also a very important leader. Those guys are today trying to, as well as other black South Africans who have come out of South Africa in the last couple of years, are trying to reform the whole way that the external liberation movements deal with South Africa from their perspective. And I'd like to talk about that because they're looking to the church. I talked to Ben Quapo a week ago Sunday. And he talked about how they have now decided that they're going to look to the churches here for their support. Because they said, we kind of give up on the liberal organizations because they have all got political ties with either the ANC or the PAC, and they're a little bit nervous about us because they don't quite know, you know, they're afraid that we're not going to win. He says, Americans are sort of opportunistic. They want to back a winner all the time. And we kind of feel that maybe the Christians are the best people for us to try and talk to, and he is in New York City this week talking to the director of the Africa director of the National Council of Churches to see what they can do about putting together some fundraising schemes so that these people can open an office. So that when we want to know how can we help South Africa, we don't have to listen to the advice of other Americans, who ultimately are not the best people to design the solutions for South Africa. And I believe, well, we'll talk about that tomorrow, what they're doing, what kind of ideas they have. Some very exciting stuff that I doubt anyone in this room would have any problems supporting, if you know about it. And that's the key. So the bell's ringing. Why don't we say the people who want to go to dinner can go. Those who would like to engage in a question-answer discussion, stay, and we can continue that as you wish. Whether or not tribalism is a problem in South Africa, it certainly is. And it is at the root of the government's policy. That's why the government sets up a Xhosa University and a Zulu University and a Tswana University. That's why the government sets up in Soweto the Xhosa area and the Tswana area and the Zulu area, to keep people divided along ethnic lines. Now, the first thing that the Black Consciousness Movement did was to define what do we mean by black. And they decided that by black they meant anyone who experiences racial discrimination. So that they were attempting to overcome not only the problem of ethnic tribalism among Africans, but also the fact that Africans were divided from colored and from Indians. And they have brought all those people into a movement and have achieved remarkable success to a scale that I don't find present anywhere else on the continent of Africa at overcoming this problem of tribalism. Now, I don't mean to say that it is no longer a problem in South Africa. It is. Not all people are in the Black Consciousness Movement, and even in the BCM, it can still be a problem at times. But I think what they have shown us is an ability to address their own problems, and that particular problem head on, and to make progress at dealing with it. And they've made a lot of progress on that. So it is a big problem, and it is something to be concerned about, but I think that they are making good progress on it. And I think that ultimately, blacks in South Africa probably stand the best chance of blacks anywhere on the continent of really helping the whole of Africa to overcome that problem of ethnic chauvinism, which is a problem largely due to the colonial powers who came in and drew geographic boundaries to suit their own interests and often divided tribes. You know, the Mende tribes in West Africa fall in two or three different countries. And in the countries where they are, they're supposed to mix it up with other tribes. And so it has been a real problem, but one that I think progress has been made on. Yeah.
Does Andrew Young have any positive effect on the South African situation?
I talked about Andy Young to Biko at one point, and he said, well, ultimately, we know where the guy comes down, because he was in South Africa, he addressed a group of businessmen there, and he said, ultimately, he believes that the best hope lies in the businessmen, that they are the ones who really ought to try and make progressive schemes to lead the rest of South Africa. But he said, we think Young is a little bit naive, because he comes here and he tells us that all we need to do is follow the example set by blacks in the South and in the States during the 1960s, that all they need to do is do what the blacks did in the South. Well, he said, first of all, we were doing that decades before Young did it in the South, A, and B, in South Africa, or in the States, blacks had to contend with a few snipers who were then sometimes searched for by the police and prosecuted. In South Africa, when we march nonviolently, we're slaughtered with machine guns. And that makes it a fundamentally different situation, and we think Young ought to pay more attention to that. So I think they're cynical about Young, but at the same time, he says, you know, somebody like Young can be helpful. They're very cynical about the American government, and when they get somebody who they think is a little bit better than the people they had, and they certainly consider Carter better than Ford, they appreciate that kind of improvement. But they still didn't really look up to Young or respect him. Why? They said it helps that we got somebody now who, if we want to try and get a visa for one of our people, we can get to Young, and he might, you know, speak out on our behalf. And it's helpful that Young listens to African diplomats a little bit more than former UN representatives did. But ultimately, he still thinks that the answers to South Africa lie in America. And we know that that's not true.
Anyone who thinks that in the South, all of them have contended with smokers, was wrong.
Well,
there were Lincoln, there's a long history of Lincoln.
Yeah, but that was that has always been illegal activity. It has not always been prosecuted.
And well, there was official activity also not in Lincoln that I knew of, that was ignored by the officials. And there was deliberate more than harassing of school children. There was harassing officially of marches and deliberate playing of some of the marches.
Right, but that was always illegal. Now, it was sometimes overlooked. The officials overlooked it at times, but it was still, according to the Constitution, illegal to shoot those marches or to win people. In South Africa, blacks have to deal with the fact that it's the police operating legally. And now, since the riots in 76, there's been legislation passed in South Africa which absolves police from any suit that can be filed against them when in a riot situation they begin firing each other again. Okay, go ahead.
I wondered what impact delegates to the UN stuff have on the Black Constitution or information about that around the world.
I'm not sure. You mean the South representatives of the South African government?
Yes.
Well, they have walked out of the UN a few years ago and have never come back because the UN has consistently for the last many years condemned South Africa and its policies. And so South Africa just doesn't participate in the UN anymore.
How about any
of the
delegates?
Well, other African delegates, first of all, the delegates of South Africa at the UN would of course be white. Because the government of South Africa is white. So they would send white delegates to the UN. Now the other African countries are very concerned about South Africa. And they have been trying to take action vis-a-vis South Africa for a long time. And every time they do, the major stumbling block which they hit is the veto of the U.S. and the Security Council. The other African nations have been calling for economic sanctions against South Africa for many, many years. And it's always the U.S. and Britain and France, which have extensive economic interests in South Africa, that veto any kind of economic embargo. Yes, sir.
The British traditionally had trouble being ruthless with non-violence. How are the rulers in South Africa responding to this?
Well, just describe a little bit more what you mean by British being ruthless.
Oh, not being ruthless. Not like in India. The non-violent movement there was successful. The British had no stomach for mass destruction of the people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the English don't like to meet non-violence and machine guns.
Right.
Now, where do they sit when they see machine guns used against 15-year-olds?
Well, one of the advantages of putting the 15-year-old black children 15 miles outside of Johannesburg is that you don't have to see it. And white South Africans don't know any more about, they know less about what happens in the black context than we do. And generally we don't know what's going on. You know, so one of the, you know, fortunate things for our conscience in America or Britain or white South Africa is that we don't know. I mean, sometimes I think I should really try and dramatically describe what blacks in South Africa are going through right now or in Namibia. You know, the extensive torture that a lot of people are facing every day, and the unbelievable brutality of police. In Soweto, when people were being killed, shot, then there would be a funeral. Now, funerals in African custom are deeply religious and solemn occasions. And blacks would gather around the graveside. I've heard personal eyewitness stories of this kind of thing. Blacks would gather around the graveside to bury a student who was questioned by police and came out of police questioning dead. And the police saying, of course, that he jumped out of a window or something and killed himself. But people don't believe that. Blacks don't believe that. So they would go quietly to the seminary to bury their school children, and they would sing some freedom songs and hold their fists up in a black salute as they, you know, really grappled with their grief at this point, only to find carloads of police pulling up and start firing at these crowds. Because the police say, this is a gathering of blacks who are angry and it's dangerous. And generally the whites believe that, whites in South Africa or anywhere else, believe that the police take what action they must take. And generally we don't know how widespread that is. So we don't have to be concerned about it. And that's why I say that our basic problem is that we don't know what's going on. We don't know to what extent we are responsible for South Africa. I'm going to show a slideshow tomorrow night which describes some of the involvement of American banks in financing the South African economy. And because we don't know what's going on, and because we consider it a luxury to go and listen to something on South Africa, you know, something that we don't really have to do, but, you know, we'll open up a little bit, that this is somebody else's business, we simply don't know what's going on, and so it can continue to happen. And my concern is, you know, I don't think that Americans are evil or greedy monsters, the way a lot of people are starting to think about it. I just think we don't know what's going on.
Well, what do you think would happen if the U.S. and the French did put an embargo on South Africa? Wouldn't that just kind of ruin the economy and ruin everything for the blacks and the whites at the same time?
First of all, I think the first economies that would feel that would be, British economy would feel it the worst. And if any of you know anything about the current state of the British economy, they're in bad trouble. I think we got it bad here, it's much worse there. And Britain has heavy economic involvement in South Africa. So it would virtually ruin the British economy. Now, as far as the South African economy, it would hurt it. And no question that South Africans would be hurt by an economic embargo. And probably a lot of the suffering would be felt first in the black community. But, now Biko says, you leave it to us to decide what kind of suffering we think is best. Because we're suffering at the moment, and we're going to have to suffer a lot more before there's change. But frankly, we would prefer the suffering which comes out of increased unemployment than the kind of suffering which we know is going to be involved with taking up arms. And they believe that by our standing here in the United States and talking about how we don't want to hurt blacks in South Africa, so we won't economically embargo them, they believe that we are driving them to guns. And they are not bloodthirsty savages who are anxious to pick up guns or anything like that. Africans much, much less than our culture, and nobody in our culture likes to, or not too many people like to do that. So that they're very familiar with the tremendous cost of suffering involved in taking up arms. But they're also very clear that they are not going to tolerate things as they are.
Yeah. I believe it's the National Geographic had an article on Africa, and there's quite a group of revolutionaries who have been intimidating the workers on the plantations and so on, and removing those, and the colonists carrying guns all the time. Now, are these revolutionaries a takeoff of some of these organizations here, or what? Or is that a new organization that's more recent, where they are using force?
Mm-hmm.
The way it spoke, there's a lot of them that are using force now.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the Africans who are protesting. Yeah. I suspect that you're talking about Rhodesia and Namibia, which are situations that in terms of a guerrilla war have deteriorated much more than in South Africa. South Africa does not have a wide-scale active guerrilla war going on at the moment. Namibia and Rhodesia do, and maybe we need to say something, maybe tomorrow we can talk a little bit about how South Africa fits into the other Southern African situations of Namibia and Rhodesia, where there are much more active wars going on at the moment, and I suspect this is what you're talking about. I think that we got to realize, and we get plenty of reports about that in this country. As soon as blacks start resorting to violence, we get tons of information about that. If there are a few whites killed at a mission station in Rhodesia, that is headline news. If 980 blacks are killed on Good Friday in raids by the white Rhodesian government, that makes an article this big on the back page. Now, I don't know how to understand that except in terms maybe of some racism. I think the important thing for us is to look for a situation which has not deteriorated yet into a guerrilla war, and try and find out what's going on there before it gets to that state. Because once people start using violence, it always escalates violence and you get charges of atrocities on both sides. And it's very difficult for us to really understand what's going on. I think that if we look historically at any of these situations, we find out that most of the violence is initially perpetrated by whites. Dr. Paul Wee, Executive Secretary of Lutheran World Ministries, or something like that, I don't know what his title is, New York City, big Lutheran in this country, is quoted in this article, which was published in last week's issue of Africa News, a weekly news journal on Africa, as talking about the situation in Namibia right now. And in his words, he believes that most of the violence going on right, yeah, here it is. During his 8-day visit in June, Wee says he heard many stories of intimidation, torture, detainment, and death, primarily at the hands of the South African Army units. So that I think we are right to be concerned about the use of violence by blacks in the liberation movements in Africa. But we've got to understand that, in my opinion, the use of that violence is overwhelmingly a response to much, much, much more violence that has been occurring for a much longer period of time from the whites. It's true that violence creates more violence. And the white Western powers have been guilty of most of the violence up till now, so we've got to expect that there's probably going to be a response of some violence on the part of blacks. And really to view that as something we have some responsibility for. It was only after we had given the South African government time to develop their own arms industries that the United States agreed to a UN call for an arms embargo against South Africa. For the years during which we were still helping South Africa develop its arms industries, we used our veto at the Security Council to block an arms embargo. Sorry, did you want to respond?
This would be out of that territory and a little different, but in Nairobi, we walked about a half a block from the hotel, and that's supposed to be very acceptable to the whites and tourists and so on, but the looks we were getting from the people there, the natives, was most intimidating, and we both, without saying so, turned around and went back.
Well, I think, you know, a lot of perception is always governed by our own fears sometimes. But maybe as a counter to your report, I'd like to state that whites, Kenya, which where Nairobi is, was a place where a lot of white colonists had settled. And when there was the revolution which brought a black government to power in Kenya, a lot of whites left because they were afraid of what was going to happen. And if you talk to whites who stayed, most of them say today that they have it better off today than they ever had it under British rule. And that a lot of whites who stay in Africa after blacks come to power are usually report this unbelievable capacity of Africans and the African culture for forgiveness. So you may have experienced some problems. Any cities, anywhere, there are desperate people who can give you trouble, but generally I believe that a lot of our fears about Africa are not are understandable given our own cultural worldview and where we're coming from, and a lot of our guilt, but are not have not been historically proven justified.
Earlier, this morning, we were talking about the amount of money that's spent on education for blacks. Versus whites in South Africa, and the amount being phenomenally different. And also about the education is really being an important part of that sort of change type of movement. What effect is the education level on the blacks going to have? When blacks come into power, if blacks come into power, is there going to be a majority of uneducated people in power, or is that gradually? We're talking about black universities also, and how do they compare to the universities of white and British?
Well, the black, to take the last part first, black universities are generally considered not as good as the white universities. And this has been particularly bitter pill for blacks to swallow, because up until 1954, there were certain universities where whites and blacks studied together, and blacks were able to have a few blacks were able to have a good quality university education, and it was a bitter pill for them to then be forced into inferior universities. Now I think that you can't really predict what's going to happen, because we don't know what kind of struggle people are going to have to go through first to attain that independence. And we don't know how many whites are going to leave at the time of independence. But all the people in the Black Consciousness Movement that I talked to made it very clear that they want to keep a lot of the advanced technological structures which they have at the moment. They want to keep running that. And they know that at the moment they don't have all of the skills necessary to run those institutions. So they want to work with whites to maintain that kind of thing. The only thing they're asking is that a black person, from the time that blacks come to power, ought to have the right to train for those jobs. They're not going to try and put blacks into positions that blacks don't know anything about how to run. They want the right to train for those positions. And secondly, if Rhodesia is any example, we can expect that there will be huge numbers of black South Africans who flee the country as refugees, and who get educational training in this country and in other African countries and in European countries, and will be qualified to, at the time that blacks come to power in South Africa, go back home. And we can hope. Rhodesia today has the highest per capita number of students studying outside of its borders of any country in the world. And this is largely due to Westerners who want to support the refugees but don't want to give them military training, and so instead give them academic training. Now, one of the problems with Rhodesia is that if you got a black government there tomorrow, and I don't consider the current government black, I don't consider a government where the military and the judiciary are entirely in white hands, and where whites have an undue proportion of representation in the parliament, I don't consider that a black government. If you were to get a black government in Rhodesia today, half of all of those students studying outside probably wouldn't go back, for reasons that we'll go into more tomorrow. But people in the Black Consciousness Movement are very sensitive to the problems involved there and have some very cogent strategies worked out for how they will accumulate educational resources over the next few years and be able to use those when they go back. And also, it's not true that blacks have no educational skills at the moment. There are black universities, and a case can be made that there are more educational opportunities available to blacks than there are anywhere else in Africa. Now, blacks argue that, well, that's of course true. South Africa is an industrialized country. It's the only industrialized country in Africa. So it stands to reason that they have the wealth to build a few more hospitals and a few more educational institutions than another part of Africa. And that's not the... comparing them with the rest of Africa is not the real issue. The real issue is comparing them with whites in South Africa. And there's obvious inequality. And then we'll take your question.
Is the South African government doing anything besides helping gestures to what helped the black movement?
Yeah, I don't think it's fair to call the gestures which they're making at the moment simply a token. Well, they're not trying to help the movement. I mean, they're trying to suppress the black movement, but they are trying to make reforms to help blacks. There has been a lot of rethinking of the whole apartheid system in the Afrikaans community in the last few years. Now, make no mistake, I would say probably at least half and maybe a majority of the white South Africans, particularly the Afrikaners, are still very strong, that the only way you deal with this is with a firm hand, and you don't give blacks any kind of second chance. But there is a growing minority of whites in South Africa who say, maybe we have been wrong. Maybe things have not worked out the way we thought they were going to. And so maybe we need to go back to the drawing board. But I don't think that's going to solve it. Because as long as whites still think that they can design the future for blacks in South Africa, there's going to be a revolt. It's not until blacks are given the opportunity to participate with whites in the government that blacks will be satisfied. And I don't find, I think when I was there, and since I left from the reports I get no signs that is very widespread. I have a few friends who do feel that way, very strongly. But they are very despairing today. The letter I had last week from a very astute observer of the Afrikaans community, an Afrikaner, said that, you know, in spite of the new reports coming out of South Africa in the last couple of months of great reform, and there was a lot of reports about reform in May, which are getting a lot of publicity in this country now, she is very, very pessimistic. And she is by nature a highly optimistic person, so that's significant. Yes, sir?
You spoke of machine gunning and firing on the blacks. It's the blacks that are behind those guns, isn't it?
No, I was referring to the police.
Well,
in South Africa, it's the police who are using most of the guns.
Aren't there some, just the leaders and then the police force itself is black?
No. Well, most of the police, when a riot breaks out in Soweto, it's the white police who are sent in to deal with it. There are black policemen in Soweto, and sometimes they use guns. But most of the violence that I've been talking about, and I believe that most of the violence being perpetrated in South Africa today, is being perpetrated by whites with guns. Most of the guns are owned by whites. Blacks can't own guns. It's illegal. Now, they have been trying to smuggle a few of them into the country, and occasionally they are successful at using those guns. But that's a tremendous minority of the times that guns are being used in South Africa today. And the machine guns, when I talk about blacks being fired upon, it's by whites. Now, there are times when black policemen fire on blacks, too. But there are reasons, I think, to explain that, and mainly is the incredible unemployment rate in South Africa and the fact that police are one of the few secure middle-class positions that a black can get. But very rarely do whites trust blacks to put down a rebellion by blacks. Whites use that. In the army, for example, it's only whites who are trained to fight.
There must be some cracks appearing in this, though, that are encouraging to them. The Christian Science Monitor within the last 2 weeks indicates that whites are moving quietly and discreetly from the 50 to 100 mile border strip along the north.
Mm-hmm. Moving away from that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
They're finding it increasingly difficult to get people to live there. They can't even give soldiers mustering out the land because they don't want to live there. More people are leaving, white people are leaving South Africa.
Right. You're referring, this is South Africa. Here is Mozambique. Up here is Namibia. Namibia, by the way, is a nation where 90% of the 1 million people are Christian. And over half of all the people in Namibia are Lutherans. Rhodesia is over here. Rhodesia, you know, Bishop Abel Muzorewa, a Methodist bishop. In many ways, I get into Methodist circles regularly, and Methodists are really stewing these days because they realize that they didn't get behind their man when it was still possible to bring him to power. And they waited too long, and now they're really in hot water. And they often say to me, well, I hope that you and the Lutherans will be smarter in dealing with Namibia than we Methodists were in dealing with Rhodesia. Then there's a nation here called Botswana, which was a British colony until the 1960s and now has independence, a black government, but no economic infrastructure of its own. Botswana goes all the way over here. Now traditionally, white South Africa, the industrial power, has always been insulated by a band through here where whites were in charge. You know, a typical African underdeveloped country where whites were in charge. And since 1975, when the Portuguese abandoned Mozambique and Angola, the black African border has been moving southward. Today the wars are going on in Namibia and Rhodesia. And whites in South Africa know that when black governments come all the way across here, you are now going to be able to execute a widespread guerrilla war against South Africa. Guerrilla war really works much more effectively when you've got a sympathetic government that will allow you to have camps in that country. And so the farmers up here in this border region are, as you're saying, moving out of the borders because they know that they're going to be the first to get hit when the guerrilla war steps up, as it has already begun to.
There is guerrilla warfare right now, isn't there?
Yeah. There's a limited amount, and there's been increased guerrilla activity since the Waco blew up in 76. The last report I heard, and I don't get as many as I wish I don't stay in touch with the information as well as I wish I could, but because it's not as available as I would like. But the last report I heard was that some guerrillas had gotten into Soweto and attacked a police station inside Soweto. And there have been times when some of the farmers in these areas have already, when blacks come onto the farm and they attack the white farmer. Now that seems very brutal to us, but I think that unless we understand the kind of brutality which they've been exposed to, we are not fair to judge the brutality which they resort to, because violence does create violence. And there's been a lot of it going on for a long time.
No, the present government took over in Southern Africa in like 48, uh-huh. And you said they worked with coalition with another group. What about the English speaking taking back over the government? The English.
Well,
or what percentage did the other people win by in 48?
Yeah, they won by a narrow percentage in 48, but the first thing they did was to make to do a little gerrymandering and to make a rural vote worth more than an urban vote. And the Afrikaners are largely rural population, the English are largely urban. But I don't think that that's, the English complain about that and say, what can we do? But the fact remains that with every election since 1948, the Afrikaner government has been claiming an increasing majority of the English-speaking votes. And it's an overwhelming, in the last election, which was just before I left the country in November of 77. Whites, the national government won something like if there are 250 seats in the parliament, the national party has got 238 or something like that. So that English-speaking whites are very clearly voting with the Afrikaans government, and I think that's because of fear. There's a lot of fear in the white community. And a lot of whites leaving.